Bonnie Glaser, director of the Asia program at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. In this episode of China Global, we will discuss China's economic statecraft in the developing world and its implications for the United States and Europe. 8 years has passed since the introduction of the Belt and Road Initiative, President Xi Jinping's hallmark foreign policy, and it's gone truly global, making significant inroads into the developing world. Of the 140 bilateral BRI MOUs signed between the PRC and its partners, 85 of them have been with countries in Latin America, the Caribbean, sub-Saharan Africa, South and Southeast Asia, and the Pacific. In some ways, the BRI has formalized the PRC's pre-existing trade and investment practices in these regions. However, the initiative also reflects a more ambitious phase in Beijing's economic strategy in the developing world. And to date, the United States and its allies are still in search of an effective multilateral response. Can alternative economic initiatives, like the G7's recently introduced Build Back Better World, B3W, can they compete with the BRI in developing nations? To discuss China's economic strategy in the developing world, I'm happy to welcome Dr. Matt Furchin, who's head of China Global Research at the Mercator Institute for China Studies in Berlin. His research interests include Chinese economic statecraft, the Belt and Road Initiative in developing nations, and U.S.-China ties. Welcome to China Global, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Bonnie.
So I read this paper that you published a few months ago. It's really interesting. It's titled China's Rule and Standard Setting Ambitions for Global Trade. And this, you co-authored this with some of your colleagues. And you wrote in that report, China's trade ties to Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia constitute a crucial component of its developing country diplomacy, which aims to simultaneously strengthen China's comprehensive commercial and geopolitical ties to these regions. So, of course, China's had close ties with developing countries for many decades. What's new about its developing country diplomacy today and its economic strategy in the developing world?
Great. Thanks, Bonnie. So I think it's important to understand that broader background, because at least since the 1950s, China has sought to be a leader and to create a kind of solidarity with what was at the time known as the Third World. So we certainly have these China-Asia, China-Africa, and to an extent, China-Latin-America connections going all the way back to the 1950s. So there was a certain element of that during the Mao era, and certainly a part of the U.S.-China competition also goes back to that sort of competition in the Third World in the Cold War era. But there really was a new phase of China's outreach to the developing world that started in the early 2000s. And that mostly corresponded with a boom in commodity trade, where China started to bring in vast amounts of energy, agricultural, and mining products from places like South America and sub-Saharan Africa. And then there's really this third phase, which you just commented on, which is kind of the post-commodity boom era, which then also overlaps with the BRI. So 2013 and onward, where there's a big concerted push on China's part to expand Chinese investment and financing, a lot of it really corresponding with commodities still. But we're really in this sort of third phase now, where there's more of a concerted effort that overlaps with the BRI.
So in what ways does China's strategy vary both between and within these various regions in the developing world? So they mainly have one strategy that they apply? Do they take into account the unique circumstances in specific regions?
Yeah, there are some commonalities, which I think are sometimes overlooked. One of those is just the rhetorical push to argue that China's a good partner in development. And this sort of goes back again to some of these themes from all the way back to the 1950s, a sort of solidarity with developing countries in Asia, in Africa, and Latin America. I think that's a lot of what we see in the BRI, is China saying, well, here's us coming with development opportunities. So you see that similarity across all of these regions. You definitely see this commodity theme, China demanding commodities from sub-Saharan Africa and South America. So there's that commonality. I think there was a sort of easy phase in a way that corresponded with the boom in trade ties in Africa and Latin America that China sort of hoped would also carry over into Southeast Asia. There's a lot of talk of how common development opportunities, common prosperity can also sort of cover over some of the more difficult security issues in Southeast Asia. So I think there's a hope on China's part that some of this development theme and the idea that common prosperity can overcome some of the more difficult issues, even in Southeast Asia, there's an effort to sort of link those, and you see that throughout the BRI.
So obviously, China, like all countries, has been dealing with COVID-19 not only at home, but also in its relations with the rest of the world. So how has the pandemic hindered Beijing's developing country diplomacy? Maybe it's really created more opportunities. So has it hindered it, or has it created more opportunities for China?
Well, just taking one quick step back, I think there's a lot of reason to focus on COVID and the post-COVID era. But I would say that one of the more significant changes that really happened in China's developing country economic ties and its overall diplomacy really was the end of the commodity boom around 2013 or 2014, which really floated a lot, again, of the economic and diplomatic ties. So I would say that there was an important change in the relationship between China and its relations, again, especially with South America and Africa, but also to a certain extent in Southeast Asia as well. But then COVID has been really an important marker of change as well. It's been a challenge, certainly, in terms of just of maintaining the trade ties, but also China's investment and finance in these regions, which has really slowed down. It was slowing down prior to COVID, but obviously the global crisis, economic crisis and health crisis has added to that. But on the other side, China has really made a concerted push to sell itself as a good health partner through COVID vaccinations, but also sales, trade of other medical supplies. So through its Health Silk Road initiative, which is sort of building on the BRI, so China has made a big push for vaccine diplomacy in all these regions. That started initially in 2015 or so with a focus on Southeast Asia, but then a lot of emphasis in Africa and Latin America and the Caribbean over the last year and a half.
When people talk about the BRI and China's economic presence around the world, there's often a lot of criticism, and there's often focus on the supply side, what China is doing. And often there isn't enough talk about the agency and the influence of the recipient actors, those countries in the developing world. Of course, there's not only this push, but there's this pull. These countries really do want to gain these economic benefits from China. And some of the problems in that economic relationship then, I think, have been caused by the recipient actors themselves. So I'm wondering if you agree with that and how you think about the local players and whether, in fact, this whole narrative of debt trap diplomacy and China pursuing win-win cooperation, and that meaning when China wins twice, should that be the dominant narrative, or are we really missing the agency of local actors?
Yeah, I think this local actor agency host countries businesses is huge. To me, this should just be common sense that we really need to take seriously the demand side of countries, whether it's part of the BRI or just broader trade and investment and financial relations. Many, many, if not the absolute majority of BRI projects are those that are put forward by host countries or businesses. And that accounts accounts for sort of some of the patterns we see. Why do we see so many coal-fired power plants in Pakistan or in Vietnam or elsewhere in Asian part of the BRI that's been so problematic and criticized? It's because of local demand. There is a price point. There's interest in this. There are relationships between energy producers and local governments that explain why we see so many of these coal-fired power plants and many, many of the other sorts of big infrastructure projects. So I think one of the things we need to take into account here is that sometimes this local agency can be good. It's important to understand, but it can also be a problem. Why do we see the certain corruption outcomes? Why do we see bad project planning? Why do we see a lack of a sufficient planning around environmental impact? It has to do with local capacity and some of the bad decisions or politically motivated decisions, including in the case, I think, of Sri Lanka, or much of what I've seen in the case of the Venezuela-China relationship. So much of this has to do with the way things were structured by the host country.
I'm curious if you could talk maybe a little bit about the attitudes in general in some of these developing countries toward China and its BRI and its development and investment in these countries. There is this narrative that in the developed world, and public opinion polls really do confirm this, there's increasingly negative attitudes toward China. But the situation in the developing world is somewhat different. So is there really a marked difference between the developing world and the developed world and their attitude towards China? And what's the trend?
Yeah, I think this is a really important question. And we see variation certainly within countries, within regions. So in Southeast Asia, you obviously see real differences among countries. So it's going to be different, including at the national level. So in Cambodia, you may have a very close relationship. You do between the governments of China and Cambodia. And you have a lot of seething resentment at the way in which Chinese investors and actors have come in and taken advantage and created problems in certain sectors. So you see variation even within countries and within regions. But I would say overall, you tend to see a much more consistent, positive attitude, especially toward the very basic agreement that countries want to have development opportunities. And China's narrative that it is offering development, whether that's through trade, investment, finance, and the BRI, that is something that resonates across all of these regions. And so I think, especially at the government-to-government level, you see a real reluctance, even if there's admission or concerns about some of the details of those trade, investment, and financial relations, that there is a general reluctance to be critical for very long periods of time about China's role, and a hope that relations can continue and can continue to improve. Societies, you see some different reactions, especially when it comes to, say, environmental impact or local community impact, a lot more criticism there. But in general, I would say that attitudes continue to be generally far more positive towards China in the developing world than in, say, the United States or Europe.
So let's focus a little bit on Latin America and the Caribbean region. Can you talk a little bit about how Beijing's economic ties with countries in that region have changed if you compare the pre-BRI period to what has transpired since then?
Yeah, I really think that this is one of the cases where BRI has not been a game changer at all. And this goes back to my previous comment about the commodity boom. That was really the most important aspect of that relationship, especially between China and South America. So that relationship boomed. Again, things like soy products, but also energy, oil, as well as iron ore and copper. Those were the things that really flowed in huge amounts, transforming China quickly into the number one trade partner of a number of countries in South America in the years around 2003 or 2004. And then that all tapered off around 2013, 2014. That then created some real political difficulties, Venezuela being the most extreme example, but also Brazil, where you saw this flourishing relationship around 2010, including through BRICS, and that's all fallen off dramatically. But when you look at BRI, that's had a pretty major impact in the Caribbean and Central America, where a lot of the countries that have signed BRI MOUs with China have come from Central America and the Caribbean region. But it's also elicited a pushback from the U.S. So I don't think the BRI has not been a huge game changer in terms of trade and investment patterns, but it has changed the nature of some of the diplomatic relations in the region, and I think exacerbated some of the U.S.-China tensions in the region.
And another interesting thing about, of course, that part of the world is that Taiwan has a number of its diplomatic allies in Latin America. Of the 15 nations that it retains diplomatic relations with, 9 of them are in Latin America and the Caribbean. So how does that affect the way that China approaches the region? Is its desire to undermine Taiwan's relations with countries in Latin America and the Caribbean a main driver for the PRC? Or does it complicate Beijing's ability to really make inroads in the region?
Yeah, this really is one of those areas where the sub-regions are important. So this doesn't have much effect at all on the China-South America relationship, which is really where the ballast of that relationship is and where all the commodity-based relations have flourished. But it's much more important in the Caribbean and in Central America. And you saw a real turning point around 2018 or so when countries in the region, including Panama, changed their diplomatic recognition from Taiwan to the PRC. And then again, this elicited part of the pushback from the United States as well. Costa Rica changed its diplomatic recognition much earlier, and that really didn't cause too many difficulties overall in that relationship between Taiwan and China and the United States. And it didn't really even create a flood of changes. It didn't all of a sudden mean a bunch of other countries in the region started to change their diplomatic recognition. That didn't happen until 2018. But I would say since then, this has become, this region is again in play for China diplomatically, but there's also just less business to be done in the region. So there are some diplomatic chips to be played, but overall, China still puts most of its emphasis on South America and, to a certain extent, Mexico.
You also noted in the report that China doesn't have a free trade agreement with Mercosur, the South American trade bloc, which has 4 full members, Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay. And then there are these several associate countries. So what are the obstacles to negotiating an agreement? Is there evidence that China wants this kind of agreement? And why hasn't it been able to achieve this?
I think this is one of these examples where the relationship, the trade relationship between China and those Mercosur countries took off without a free trade agreement. It just wasn't necessary. It may have created some more opportunities for even greater flows of trade. But again, going back to this period around 2003 or 2004, exports of Brazilian and Argentine soy or Brazilian iron ore just took off in a way that was unprecedented without a free trade agreement. So China was signing free trade agreements with other countries in the region, for example, Chile or Peru, and that facilitated some of their trade. But Mercosur is known as not being a free trade bloc in the first place, but it just sort of highlights that some of this trade could and did take off even in the absence of a trade agreement. So you see the European Union putting a lot of emphasis on creating an EU-Mercosur free trade agreement, and the hope there is to set some standards, including on environment. But in the meantime, China and Chinese traders have just taken off in terms of their trade relationship with the region. And I'm not sure there's a major diplomatic need or push for a free trade agreement between China and Mercosur.
Well, you just mentioned standards, so let's talk a little bit about that. There is an increasing attention being paid to the fact that China is trying to set standards. You specifically mentioned the environment. What are the other areas that China's trying to set standards in, and why is this a threat?
Well, there's certainly a lot of efforts on China's part to ensure that it is creating some of its own standards as opposed to those that are maybe set by other bodies, including the WTO. China has been signing many of its own free trade agreements. Again, many of those in developing country regions. Part of that is rhetorical to show that China can play the high-level trade standards game. But in the report we did for Merricks last year and that was published earlier this summer, there's an emphasis also on the ways in which China is going about pursuing non-traditional kinds of trade standards, including by setting up legal arbitration centers, special economic zones, and ways of doing sort of standard setting that are outside of the norm that, say, the United States or the EU are used to. And some of that allows for China to set the tone of how it goes about doing commerce, but also potentially building in longer-term patterns of trade and economic relations that then allow China to potentially have leverage over countries in these regions in the future.
And one of the things that you advocated in this report is that the United States and Europe coordinate on infrastructure standards and on financially and environmentally sustainable infrastructure. So let's talk a little bit about the policy responses here. What can the U.S. and Europe do that can shape maybe the impact of what China is doing, maybe set our own standards, compete with China more effectively? I mean, essentially, we've been talking for many years about BRI counter strategies. And Europe is now talking about the Global Gateway Plan. The Biden administration is talking about Build Back Better World. And yet it seems to me that there is more on paper so far than in reality. So what is it we should be doing, and why is it so difficult?
That's a great question. I think this is one of these areas that you've seen these lists of very long possibilities for transatlantic cooperation on China issues. And I would say this is an area that still, to my mind, is low-hanging fruit, where the U.S. wants to do more to sort of counter the BRI or offer alternatives. Europe, for a number of years now, going back to at least 2018, has talked about its own connectivity strategy, which it's sort of rebranding now. And a lot of that emphasis in Europe is on different kinds of standards, on sustainability, environmental sustainability, debt sustainability, human impact sustainability. And the question here really is, what can be done within that framework that is something that is viable, that's different than it's already on the book? So if you look at environmental standards, there are already so many initiatives already underway. The Blue Dot Network that began under consideration under the Trump administration, this is something that's been in discussion across the transatlantic, but also with Asian partners for a while. But part of what holds that up is concerns that you're just adding sort of levels of bureaucracy that's not necessarily easily implementable. So I think there's still a lot that can be done here, but I think what European partners are really searching for are some very quick projects that could be easily recognizable and that could get done right away. And I think this is where the US and Europe should look in terms of standard setting, but also in terms of the quality of finance that is available as a real alternative to some of the packages and offers that China's making.
One of the things that the Biden administration is trying to do, which is similar to the Trump administration, is to incentivize private capital to actually fund some of these projects in the developing world, because there's so much capital available in the private sector. So my sense also is that is an area that really has not made much progress. Why is that?
I'm not sure that the private sector agrees with this as a priority. I find a lot of talk on the part of governments, whether it's the US or in Europe, and to a certain extent in Asia, about things that governments might want to see, again, as alternatives to the BRI. But I see very little buy-in from the private sector. And I think this comes in both the sense of financing, but also technology. Again, if there's going to be an alternative to the provision of coal-fired power plants, how is it that alternatives in terms of solar or wind or hydro, how are those going to be financed, and how is the technology going to be provided? And I just don't see it happening unless the private sector is included. And again, even in the rollout and discussions of the new, I guess, the new Indo-Pacific strategy from the US, I see a lot of emphasis on security cooperation, a sort of sense that there won't be any clear trade component here. And then where is the private sector? So I remain deeply skeptical that there's going to be private sector buy-in. And without that, I don't see that an alternative can be put in place.
I guess a final question is that some people think that the United States and Europe really should help China's projects be implemented in a way that actually contributes to development, doesn't exacerbate corruption, doesn't add to mounting debt. And because China has so much capital that it is willing to give these countries, should this be considered as more of a collaborative effort, or because we are engaged, at least in the United States, in intense strategic competition with China, and of course, growing tensions between Europe and China, should we look at this exclusively from the frame of countering China and pushing back on its BRI strategy?
Well, to me, this goes back to your earlier question about agency. I think the most important thing that the US can do, but also the EU, the UK, is listen to what it is that host governments, business communities, civil society, what is it that they really want? I see, including in the Build Back Better World framework or all these alternatives to the BRI, I see some of that being the priorities coming from the US or Europe or other countries, and not necessarily focusing primarily on what it is that countries in Southeast Asia or Africa or Latin America themselves find that they need most. And I think that discussion needs to start with them. I've long advocated that there could be more done to build capacity in developing countries to deal with China or anyone really on their own terms and in their own interests. And I think this is something that's started, but there's a lot more room for that kind of capacity building. Again, it requires close listening to governments, businesses, and civil society in these developing country regions.
We've been talking with Matt Furchin, who is head of global China research at the Mercator Institute for China Studies in Berlin. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Bonnie.